Welcome to Careers in Discovery, where you'll meet scientists who've forged outstanding careers in biotech and hear about what they've learned along the way. This podcast is brought to you by Singular, building brilliant biotechs.
I am back this week on Careers in Discovery with Bill Eldridge of Isagenica. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Really good to see you. Bill, we always start by talking a little bit about what you're up to. It'd be great to hear, for those who aren't familiar, a little bit about Isagenica and what you've got going on there, and tell us a bit about the company.
Yeah, sure. So Isagenica are a VHH discovery company, and VHH, for those of you that don't know what a VHH is, it's an antibody fragment that originally was derived from camels, or llamas, in fact.
Okay.
So they're called camelid antibodies. They've got these very special properties that allows you to take the sort of binding element of the antibody off, and you can sort of daisy chain them together. They're very, very small. So they're like tiny, tiny antibodies, about a tenth of the size of an antibody themselves, a normal antibody. And you can do all kinds of really interesting things with them, which makes them really adaptable for, say, CAR T therapies or making bispecific antibodies, because you can sort of change the specificities at the end. We have a panel of albumin binders that allows us to kind of modify the half-life of these molecules in the blood as well. So we offer that as a sort of combined package with our ability to discover antibodies to pretty much any target you can think of. At a speed and a diversity of output that is simply not possible by just injecting a poor old llama in a field, an unsuspecting llama. We do all of this in a test tube. We have literally, a trillion antibodies in a teardrop of liquid that we select out the individual antibodies from, and we can do that in a very, very short time.
Yeah, I see. And it's interesting because, of course, there's so much hype around cell and gene therapies these days, and there's been a resurgence of small molecules, but there's still, of course, a huge amount of unexplored territory in antibodies, right?
Enormous, and it's a growing field. And I think, although we sound a little bit niche in the VHH world, there have been four approved drugs in the last 4 years based on VHH, including mainly in the antibody space, but also in CAR T as well. And there's a slew of VHH based drugs coming along behind that, moving through the clinic. Many in phase three, many in phase two.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you tend to partner with companies to enable their programs in a whole range of different therapies.
Exactly, yeah. And we have a lot of, we're quite a mature company. We're 25 years old. We have many, many years of successful partnerships with numerous biotech and pharma companies, dating back, as I say, 25 years.
Yes. So presumably then if someone is thinking about using VHH antibodies, there's not many places they can find out more than an Isagenica.
No, quite right. If you wanted a kind of scaling speed that we can do it at, we are the VHH company, and it says so on our website.
There you go.
Look no further. Yeah.
Yes. And Bill, you've been involved in the company kind of in different sort of phases and different roles and that kind of thing for some time, but currently as CEO.
Currently as CEO, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, no, I've got a slightly unusual story in that I am actually a founder member of Isagenica, and I did just let the cat out of the bag and say it was 25 years ago, which makes me feel terribly old, but... I was a founder member. I was one of the team that invented the original display technology called SysDisplay. And I was with the company in the first place for about 9 years. And then I left to go and be a CSO of another biotech company. And about 4 years ago, I came back originally in the alliances management role, but then moved into CSO, and now in the last couple of years, CEO role. So it's sort of like a circle. I've come back round.
Well, nice to be back, I'm sure. And we're going to talk about your career, Bill, of course. And one of the things that caught my eye about it is that you've spent time in kind of lots of different areas of what a biotech company does, right? So you've spent time on the commercial and BD side, you've obviously led the scientific end, and I suppose, you know, what you're doing now is bringing those two things together. But yeah, tell us a bit about kind of the role that you're in and what you spend most of your time on and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, so I suppose that's the attraction of biotech for me, is that you're working in a small company, and what that means is that you get exposure to so many more disciplines than you would say working in a much larger, you know, big corporation where you're probably just doing one thing.
Right.
With biotech, you're more or less forced actually to do multiple things at the same time, and that makes it exciting, nerve-wracking. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll admit that, but also really, really interesting. You get a real, you know, over time you get a real sort of deep sense of the industry and how it all works and where the value is as well. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've thrown yourself into embracing that breadth throughout.
So I have, yeah.
Well, let's dive into that. So started out in protein engineering, if my research is correct. So correct. So going right back to the beginning, you know, why science? Why protein engineering? Why then drug development? Tell us a bit about the origins of this career for you.
Yeah, well, I confess that I think I wanted to go into science from about the age of 12.
Okay.
And I was rather charmed by the word microbiology, even though I didn't really know what that was. I just thought, yeah, that sounds interesting. And I did, my upbringing was quite rural. I lived on a farm. And mm-hmm. in that farm, we had a big sort of water reservoir in those days. And that water reservoir, after many, many years, it sort of filled up with all kinds of weird wildlife and, you know, newts and beetles and things like that. And I used to spend a lot of my time lying on a raft that I'd created, just sort of looking down. And so I got more and more fascinated with the sort of tiny, unnoticed life that you see all around you. Mm-hmm. And that really did start to attract my interest into microbiology after that. So yep. I did a degree, a four-year degree, actually, at the University of Surrey. And it was there that I really got into laboratory science and the real, you know, the depth of it, the just the amazing variety and amazing sort of mechanisms and strange and beautiful molecular processes that occur all around us without us even realizing. It's just absolutely fascinating. So I got really into microbiology.
Mm.
And then I did I took a year off after the degree. But by that time, I'd already realized, because they got you to do what they call an industrial year, which is a year in industry. And it was there that I realized, gee, if you're going to go for this career, you need a PhD. If you're going to, you know, if you, it's certainly in those days, if you want to sort of progress any kind of career, it seems like you need a PhD. And anyway, mm-hmm. I loved the science, so it wasn't going to be a problem for me. It wasn't going to be a chore. So then I started looking around and thinking about what interested me. And I'd already gone down that very small road. So I just thought this PhD that was on offer at the University of Kent just sounded like really, really up my street. It was a protein engineering PhD, lots of molecular biology, but lots mm-hmm. of protein interaction as well. So sort of changing proteins and then seeing what happens to them, how they, what changed in their interaction and their biophysics and things like that. And that was very, very good preparation for me. I then, having done the PhD, I did a short postdoc period at Pfizer in mm-hmm. Sandwich, which was, you know, in those days, the University of Kent, it was right next door to Sandwich.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was kind of a conveyor belt, you know, you did your PhD at Kent and then you went to Sandwich.
Yeah.
So I spent some time there, again, doing protein engineering. But again, at that time, it seemed as though proteins and basically biotherapeutics were a bit of a niche for a big pharma company. They weren't super interested in it. It was all a bit weird and a bit squishy, and they, you know, didn't really like it. They were small molecule people. So I then started looking around for jobs that were more appropriate to my PhD. Right. I mean, I to get the experience in Sandwich, I actually wrote to the site head. I just rather naively wrote to the site head and said, oh, I'd really like to, you know, get some lab experience, if that's all right with you, Martin. And he let me in. So that, you know, if anyone's sort of thinking about that as a move, it's very exciting to meet like-minded scientists, you know.
Yeah.
So if you, you know, just writing to somebody and asking for experience is a really great way of getting a foot in the door.
Yeah. And I think people like to once they've been successful in their career, people like to help young if you like, or people here in their career, right? We've seen people be very generous with their time on this podcast, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great career, but it can also be quite frustrating and quite daunting at first. How do I get all this experience that I'm supposed to have? The old chicken and egg situation, must have 2 years experience, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You just, you know, a lot of the time you can just ask for it, you know.
Right.
You know. So that's what I did. But I realized, as I say, I realized pretty shortly that, you know, to really sort of drive my career and really be taken seriously, I wanted to go and work in a biotech company.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied to Cambridge Antibody Technology, as was. Yeah. I think I must have been about number 60 or something in the company by then. It was already doing pretty well and growing. Yeah. I think Humira had just been discovered, and it was just being, just sort of moving through very early development and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So it was all that excitement around that. And all of the other sort of amazing things that they were doing there. So I kind of learnt about antibody discovery there. I learnt about the real value that suddenly antibodies were generating, having been gone through that sort of period of doldrums where, you know, the first therapeutic antibodies had terrible, you know, immunogenicity problems and so on. So now you had a technology that addressed that, and they were producing these amazing antibodies, which turned into drugs. So that was really cool. And I spent 3 years at CAT.
Yes.
And then, as usual, I kind of got itchy feet, and I started looking around for something new. I wanted, having been in a biotech company where the guys had done something amazing and created something amazing, I wanted to do that. I wanted to go and create something novel. So I moved on. There was this opportunity at this company called Isagenica. They were a brand new company. The CEO was an ex-CAT employee.
Right, okay.
You know. And so I remember, you know, having the interview with Kevin and then joining Isagenica as a senior scientist with a few years' experience. A lot of enthusiasm, a lot of naivety, and that's where I started.
Yeah, I see, and I want to hear about that journey. Certainly, I just wanted to ask you before we move on to that. We've had several people who have come through CAT in various sort of times and functions on the podcast, and there's a huge amount of talent has come through that company. You know, we had Jane Osborne on, and we had Jane Dapper recently, and Bev Carr, and I'm sure there's others that I've forgotten, and I apologize to any people that I've forgotten. Clearly there was something in the water there, or there was something they were doing at CAT that yes, of course the science was great, but you know, as a company, are there things that you learned there that have stayed with you? And I'm thinking about this really for people who might be looking at where they should go in their career, you know, how to assess that in hindsight, I suppose, to try and.
I think what I learned at CAT was It was at the time anyway, it was a very sort of creative place.
Mm.
And there were a lot of young, really ambitious people there. And it was quite a noisy company.
Okay.
It was quite noisy, but it was also, it wasn't, but by noise, I mean noisy in a good way. So you know, what I learned about at Pfizer was you had to sort of play a bit of a game, and you had to sort of, you know, you were encouraged to ask questions, even if it's a stupid question, and make sure that you got noticed and so on and so on. There was none of that at CAT. If you had a question, great, ask the question. You weren't going to get any brownie points for it. The only thing that you were going to get out of it was learning, or that the group itself was going to get was learning. So it was very much, it was geared towards the science. It was geared towards doing things well and doing things properly. And, you know, there's a great deal of enthusiasm for trying to be creative and trying to find solutions. And that's something that's stayed with me all of my career. It's being creative and trying to think your way around a problem, as opposed to sort of throwing up your hands or just carrying on regardless.
Yes.
Oh, it doesn't really work, but we'll just carry on.
You know? Just anyway, yeah. Okay.
So it's sort of an element of quality, I think. That's what you know, what I really picked up at CAT.
No, makes sense. And then so you were into that company quite early, but even earlier at Isagenica, of course. And being right at the start is a different proposition. So tell us a bit about that part of the journey.
Yeah. So we were in a porter cabin. We were in a porter cabin for many, many years. I'd say about 8 years we were in a porter cabin at the Baverham sites outside Cambridge. And we had some funding from our Swedish shareholders. It wasn't much. And originally, the technology that the company was spun out on, it just didn't really work. It was very, very flaky. And we spent months and months and months just continually failing. Just every day, nothing worked. We just couldn't get it to work. Over and over and over and over and over again. Just failing and failing and failing. I learned a lot of techniques, and I learned a lot of troubleshooting. But at the end of the day, it's incredibly soul destroying to keep failing all the time.
Yeah, of course.
But at the same time, without wanting to over egg it, it builds resilience into you. Oh. And when you know, it builds scientific rigor into you as well, because every once in a while something would appear to work.
Mm-hmm.
And all right, we were all so cynical by that time. We started to, you know, disbelieve anything that did actually work. But we spent about, as I say, we spent about nine months or so, probably longer, trying to get this technology to work, and it just didn't. And then we were more or less given an ultimatum by a shareholder saying, you know, you have to build something that actually works, so we're just going to pull the plug on this company. This is ridiculous. You know, and you couldn't really blame them for that. So we did. We literally sat down in Kevin's office one day, a group of, I think we had about six or so scientists. And we drew up some ideas. And there was a guy there called Ricardo de Grip, who'd done his PhD on these replication-initiated proteins. So he had some ideas on what we could do instead of using the one we were using.
Right.
And he sat down with the CSO Duncan to start sort of drawing up some plans, and I think we had three original candidates for the project. Two of them failed pretty rapidly, and then I always remember, you know, Duncan, the CSO, he did the original selections, the original test selections. And he was convinced he'd got this thing to work, you know, to get this sort of, you know, this binding assay to work.
Right.
And we were all looking, you know, bearing in mind, we were all incredibly cynical by then. We were expecting failure. And we all looked at these results, and they were a bit wishy-washy, and you know, they didn't not very convincing. That the you know, signal to noise was pretty poor. I just remember Duncan saying to me afterwards, "Well, all right then, you do it. Here you are. Here's a, you know, here's a target. You will go off and do some selections." And he said, "You know, just take your time, grudgingly, take your time and do it properly." So I did. And I employed a couple of little tweaks to it. And there's that little moment in certainly in those days, where you do an ELISA, you look for binding, and your liquid turns from completely clear to a sort of dark blue. And some of the wells on my 96 well ELISA plate were turning blue, maybe about 50% of them.
Right.
And my experience from CAT told me this is working, because some of them are clear and some of them are blue. So you've obviously got binders here.
Yes.
And I just remember sort of calling to Rickard down the hallway, like, and come and look at this. And it was like, it was amazing. It was magical, literally magical. When you know, it's like that real eureka moment where suddenly the liquid goes from clear to dark right. blue. And you know, I remember all the whole team sort of crowding around and looking at this ridiculous, really looking at this ELISA plate. And I remember my hand shaking because I was like, oh my God, this has worked, and stopping the reaction, you know, and reading it and stuff like that. And it all kind of took off from there. You know, we developed the technology, we improved the process, we tweaked the process. But it was that little moment when we finally agreed, yes, no, really, this really has worked. And
yeah.
we've got something here. So we started in peptides. We learned a great deal about making libraries. So the whole point with our technology is that you can make these gigantic libraries, bigger than is possible with any other display technology. We started with libraries and offering peptide discovery services to companies, and there was quite a bit of interest in peptides at that time. So I spent about 9 years there as a research scientist, and then moving into alliance management. So as we started offering the service, you know, some of us would go out to meet potential partners. So I started learning about the partnering process. I started learning about understanding partners' needs. And I also started learning about, you know, contract negotiations, work plan development, and as well as the alliance management side, sort of keeping the partner, you know, informed, keeping them happy, discussing, you know, modifications to the plan and stuff like that. That was a great experience. So it was a mixture of alliance management and business development.
Yeah, interesting. And that commercial side, had that been something that had been kind of an interest of yours, or was it just that the company needed it done, or how did it come about?
Yeah, no, it was a real interest. And I always remember at CAT, you know, the BD team, they seem to have a lot of fun, you know, right. They seem to have a good time. Little did I know. So I kind of fancied that. I thought that was, it looked exciting, it looked interesting, and also a completely different world. I'm always sort of fascinated to learn, and it's a very different kind of perspective. It's not all technical.
Yes,
the deep technical understanding that you need when you're inventing a technology, when you're in a business development role, you really have to present it as a solution. Right. To the problems, and you have to do that both from a technical and commercial perspective. So you have to sort of mix those two worlds, be able to understand the partner's concerns and answer them. So it's a real, yeah, the interplay between the science and the commercial was really interesting. Yeah,
and I think, you know, to be good at that kind of business development, you've got to have enough technical depth, haven't you, that you can talk at that technical level. Maybe you can call someone in for a very detailed question, but you don't want to be doing that too often, right? But then, as you say, see the solution holistically, which, you know, can be challenging when you have literally been sat there watching in an isoplex.
That's exactly right. It's difficult. And, you know, you have to have, for the science side, you have to have a really, really deep understanding. And then for business development, it's partly reading your partner and, you know, sort of trying to understand what they need, but also what they'll accept in terms of, you know, what you charge them and how long things are going to take and what the output's going to be. And so that was a really great education, and that has stayed with me. And in fact, actually, Isagenica, we're encouraging the scientific team to get more and more involved in that kind of process, getting to understand partners' needs, because we do that, you know, every day. You know, when we have calls with our partners, we spend a lot of time sort of trying to understand them. Mm-hmm. The partner's going to have some sensitivities about how much can I tell you and things like that. But we come at things from the point of view of, you know, we know what we're doing here. We can really, really help you. We need a bit of help from you to, you know, a bit of information. So that's something that we do all the time. And it's something that we encourage everybody at Isagenica to get involved in.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, if you aren't someone who likes talking to people, it's probably not the right move for your career. But, I find a lot of scientists, they enjoy solving a puzzle, right? And they enjoy solving a problem. And there's very few puzzles as complex as trying to understand a group of another person, let alone a group of other people because it's always different, right? And also, I think you have to do it differently to everybody else because you've got to bring your authenticity to it. So you're not going to do it in the same way as the person next to you. So figuring that out is always a very interesting experiment.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was your experience of it too.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's nothing quite like when you're in a partnering meeting and you've got so many minutes to convince a partner.
Yeah,
and they start off with their arms folded, you know, what am I doing here? Where's the bar? And you start off with your, you know, your sort of prepped deck or whatever, and you can see a little glimmer in their eye, and then eventually as you explain more, you know, you can see the glimmer getting a little bit stronger, and then they start asking you a few questions, and then by the end of the, you know, if you've got it right, the arms come unfolded and they're leaning forwards and they're really interested. And that's a fantastic feeling. You've really kind of like reeled them in, you know, that's a fantastic feeling. It's when they start looking at their phone halfway through that, you know, you know, you haven't done it, but that's the challenge. And I I've been in both situations, obviously.
Of course,
And, so it's a fantastic feeling when you can sort of bring somebody around. You know, you can see from their body language usually. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then, so 9 years was the first period at Isagenica. And you know, that's a decent shift, I think, for anybody, particularly a biotech company.
Yeah.
You know, that's a decent run. So then tell us a bit about Cyclogenix and how that came about and your time.
So I think Duncan, my CSO at Isagenix, he had left some years prior to that. And he had he'd spent some time up in Aberdeen. That's where he started up the company. And he'd I'd got involved sort of early on with that, just some early discussions with him, and then he invited me up to be the CSO at Cyclogenix. Right. Cyclogenix had a deal with what was then Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, which was relatively quickly bought by Pfizer.
Yes.
Again, this was all groundbreaking stuff. You know, we were working on these constrained peptides called cyclotides. You find them, they're naturally expressed in many, many food plants like squashes and cucumbers and peas, corn, and stuff like that. And no doubt if you've eaten peas or corn recently, you'll have cyclotides floating around in your bloodstream.
Right.
They're these tiny little peptides, super, super tough. They're orally available, so they get into your bloodstream quite easily, having been ingested. Mm-hmm. Plants use them usually to protect their seeds from, digestion when they go through the guts of animals.
Right.
But there's a huge variety of them, and that got Duncan and me thinking the first day is, well, we could start to introduce sort of little modifications into these peptides. We could build big libraries for them, and then we could use them for, various things. They're super, mm-hmm. super tough. You can boil them, you can incubate them in acid, you can incubate them in various proteolytic mixes, and they're just untouched.
Yes.
So why don't we modify these and see if we can use them as therapeutics? So one of the things that we were really interested in was oral delivery of biotherapeutics. Mm-hmm. And the other one was getting them across the blood-brain barrier. So right. We were really, 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 really cutting edge, really, really bleeding edge science. It was, yep. It was what we did. Everything that we did was really hard.
Yes.
And we had some success, but it was incredibly challenging. Everything that we did was, really, really difficult. So the oral delivery, we'd fuse a peptide to, say, EPO or something like that. And then we'd set up preclinical studies and look for the appearance of EPO in the bloodstream of say a rat or a mouse, and that worked really well. And another one was getting various growth factors into the brains of mice as well, because that's a huge, huge challenge, is the blood-brain barrier. The brain protects itself really, really well from drugs or any foreign objects trying to get into the brain, which is a huge problem for, there are a myriad of neuronal and brain diseases, mm-hmm. that are pretty much untreatable, short of making a hole in somebody's head and injecting it directly. So we were going for that. So we went for, I think, probably the two most challenging approaches out there.
Absolutely.
So we spent 6 years in Aberdeen, and then we moved the company down to Stevenage, mm-hmm. Because there was considerably more infrastructure for biotech down in England.
Yes.
So, yeah.
It's a touch warmer as well.
It's a touch warmer. Wasn't going to mention that, but yeah.
And so that was about an 11 and a half year period. And I imagine it was different going in as the CSO and building a company. What were the differences there, do you think?
Well, now, rather than, instead of just doing the alliances and just doing the business development, and I was now not only sort of building longer term strategic kind of plans around the projects, as well as doing a bit more, I was doing plenty of business development and plenty of talking to potential partners, but I also had a team who had to be coordinated and motivated and mentored to some extent as well, depending on the level. So that was really challenging again. So now, moving away from some of the more strategic or technical aspects, moving into, the more people orientated side of things, motivating people, bringing them along with you, that side of things. And I think, I guess, as my career has progressed, I've done a lot more of that.
Yeah, of course.
So it's sort of essentially, motivating your team, getting them as excited about their science as you are.
Yeah.
Not always easy.
No.
But generally, actually, that's not true. I think in science, what makes it so attractive, one of the things that makes it so attractive, is that you are with like-minded people, and the scientists we work with, they love the science, they love it. It's really cool. And the getting the clear liquid to turn blue thing, it's kind of what we do, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. We did a survey about this kind of post-COVID, a really big one, hundreds of people, mostly scientists in biotech. And it was kind of an attitudes insight into sort of how people felt about their work, because obviously things had changed, right? And people's priorities had shifted and working arrangements had changed and all that kind of thing. And the first thing that overwhelmingly came through was that people in biotech, particularly the scientists, they love their job. They love what they do. They love the day-to-day. They're interested in it. And also they feel they're working on important stuff.
Yeah.
And I you wouldn't get that in every industry. I think there are some that you'd get it more than others, but it's overwhelmingly the case in the biotech sector.
Yeah. And I think if you're in a group where you're all working towards a common goal, then it just makes it more exciting and more interesting, you know, rather than being, you know, I know classically scientists are kind of introverts, you know, that's how we think of them, but all working towards the same goal, even introverts get excited by other people's enthusiasm, you know? So, I've certainly found that.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so eventually you found your way back to Isogenica.
Yeah.
And you know, there's kind of that cliche, isn't there, that you shouldn't go back. I don't particularly believe that. How did that happen? How did you find your way back to Isogenica?
Yeah. So I was consulting. So after Cyclogenics, I moved on. I was consulting for a couple of years to a number of companies, primarily in antibodies, one in peptides. Again, it's through my network. I think the CSO, Guy, he got in touch with me and invited me to sort of come and consult for them. Mm-hmm. and sort of help them with their alliance management.
Yeah.
So I did that. I disagree with it. It isn't really going back, I don't think. Because the company's changed enormously since I left, you know.
A lot must have happened in that time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the furniture's the same, but pretty much all of the faces are new, yeah, or were new, and the company has sort of changed its focus anyway. I don't think it was, and I instantly saw that I could help, that I could, you know, I could make a difference here and help to sort of what the then CEO Emma was doing was essentially turning the company around and driving it towards profitability, which is, yeah, you know, which is the holy grail for a CRO company, is to not just make it survive, but make it grow. And that's, you know, that legacy I've continued with. We as a team have continued with, to be more accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, things have changed a lot since you'd been there. Do you think it helped that you had been there? Do you think it would have been different if you'd gone to a completely new company, sort of knowing the origins of it and the roots of it?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I'm able to help every once in a while when somebody comes to me and says, you know, what does this acronym mean? And when they're having a clear out, I'll go, oh, no, don't jump that way. I think the fact that I am a former employee actually hasn't made... it's made minimal difference in terms of the legacy side of things. What has made a difference, what I have brought is all of that experience that I've built up over my career. And, you know, as I say, that it's a well-established company now and it has pretty well-established processes. But there are always areas that you can improve, and we are building, we have built a culture of continuous improvement, Kaizen, mm-hmm, is what we imply here. And I've also been able to bring a sort of people first approach to the company as well. And I think that really helps. The CRO can be, you know, can be very, very intense.
Yeah.
You know, you've got timelines, you've got deadlines, and you're delivering, and it's all about, you know, the partner is paying for this and they mm-hmm. need this yesterday. And so it's quite easy for people to sort of get burnt out the lab. You know, they're driven harder and harder and harder, or at least they feel they are. And a lot of the responsibility, you know, again, in a small company, you get a lot of exposure, but you also get a lot of accountability, you know. Mm-hmm. So bringing that approach, the sort of people first approach, that's certainly something that I've been able to help. Yeah. Make sure that, you know, the team feel valued and they know that they are valued and they're also part of this forward, you know, strategic vision that the company's built.
Yeah.
Yeah, super important.
And it, as you say, it's difficult to balance, right? You have to perform in that environment. But as you say, I suppose particularly for a company like yours, where it's not a case of someone sort of mastering the straightforward technique and just becoming really skilled at that. It's scientific expertise in a particular domain, right? And so retaining that expertise is really important as well. And so balancing those things, I guess, is really critical.
To deliver for a partner in our world, where a lot of the stuff that we do is bespoke, it's all tailored towards their needs and their projects, you need someone who really understands as much as it's possible about the project, about the protein, about the mechanism, about the application, about developability, cell binding, penetration, yada, 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 on and on and on. And so, you know, that builds, actually what it builds is a team of people that really care about what they do.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the quality of our output, I would say, is unparalleled. Because we generally do. We really put everything into delivering mm-hmm. for our partners. And to do that, you need really bright, really motivated people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do what we can to look after those people because they, you know, they do care so much that sometimes it can be quite emotional for them if you know, things don't go perfectly. And guess what? This is science. Yeah. And science doesn't go perfectly, we've discovered.
No.
So, yeah, it can be very intense for them. But that's because they're enthusiastic and motivated.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it. I think if it is intense, then at least it shows that you care, right?
And mm-hmm.
you know, if you stopped caring, that would be a more worrying sign.
Because then we wouldn't be able to deliver.
Yeah.
Or not the sort of level of quality that we do deliver. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And so, you know, we've sort of taken a bit of a whistle stop tour through your career there, Bill. Thinking back on it, if there was maybe one or two things that you have learned over the years or that you know now that you would have liked to have known starting out, or sort of advice that you would pass on to people who are earlier on in their career, what do you think those things would be?
So I'd start off with saying, make sure that what you're doing is fun, that it is enjoyable. Okay, number one, you've got to enjoy it. Otherwise, you know, like any career, it'll just make you miserable, it'll ruin your life if you know, if you have to drag yourself out of bed.
Mm.
Number two, I was given this advice myself, and it's, if you're in a job and you feel you're not learning anymore, then leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I think possibly in one or two situations I could have done that. I could have left a bit earlier than I did.
Yeah.
So that's definitely really good advice.
Yeah.
And then three, I think, is, again, this comes back to scientists and being introverts and not being too good at this sort of thing. But just remember, it is the people that you know. So try to go to networking events.
Right.
Try to go and meet people and talk to people. And don't go to a networking event expecting to get a job or an amazing deal or anything. Just go out and meet people and talk to like-minded scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Just get to know them. Your network, particularly in this area, in the Cambridge area, is really, really important.
Yeah.
You learn a lot. It's an opportunity to learn. It's not just about your career. It's about, you know, what you can deliver and what you can bring to your current role and how you can develop yourself. So really work on the network.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you just never know who you're going to bump into, right? And they could be the person you're calling down the hall to show that something's happening.
Yeah, yeah. But they could also be all that person that you met, you know, 2 years ago, and they're into, I don't know, alliance management, or they had that really neat tip on team leadership or OKRs or project management or whatever, or, you know, how to hold a pipette.
Yeah,
it's all that sort of stuff. Somebody that you can talk to. And the nice thing about our industry is actually, generally speaking, when you call people up and ask them a question, they'll answer it. They'll answer it honestly and openly and be willing and actually very keen to help.
Yeah.
So really, really milk that. I think perhaps if I'm guilty of anything in my earlier career, it's not doing enough of that, not doing enough, you know, networking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's easy to look at people later in their career when you're earlier in your career and assume they won't want to talk to you, right?
Yeah.
That's usually not the case.
No, it's usually not the case. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. In general, it's not the case. And also not being afraid to, you know, just ask a question that's on your mind, because... Mm-hmm. You know, 99 times out of 100, it won't be a stupid question. It'll be a, you know, very personal question.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I'd advise.
And so, Bill, tell us a little bit, going back to Isagenica and sort of where you are now, tell us a little bit about what's next.
Right. Well, what we're doing right now is we're building new... amazing humanized libraries. Mm-hmm. We're also developing an internal pipeline of those bispecific molecules that we talked about.
Yeah.
So we're kind of expanding our CRO services offering, where we're doing more marketing and more sales and letting everybody know about us, because actually it turns out not as many people know about us as we'd like.
Right.
It's a great period for VHH because it's a sort of a burgeoning field. So we're seeing a lot more interest in our services, what we can do. So we're building all of those skills that we've got already, plus our new and amazing libraries.
Yeah.
And we're galvanizing a team to sort of really build profit and growth into this quite old company.
Yeah.
That has just got mountains of potential that is currently untapped.
No, it's fantastic. Well, Bill, best of luck.
Thank you
so much for joining us and sharing your story with us. I look forward to speaking again.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for listening. Careers in Discovery is sponsored by Singular, helping you to build a brilliant biotech company. Biotech leaders spend far too much time, money, and energy on hiring and people issues. Head to www.singular-biotech.com to learn how you can recruit and engage your team more effectively so you can focus on developing medicines, treating patients, and saving lives.